You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void. The bed sank into the lake's brown glass, with each of its bedposts spinning a farewell in the form of a corkscrew of water, locking down as to the swirl of a painter's brush. When the water stilled, the morning sky offered a curious reflection of coiled linen, an airy spoof of what had lain in the water, as though the bed had fallen both down and up into lake and sky. I shifted my gaze and wondered of the vortex of bedpost-like wind that could have created such a teasing symmetry. I straightened and looked out across the lake. There was a chill upon my shoulders and a mild panic in my chest. Like a not-so-noble version of Robinson Crusoe, I'd stranded myself here. A castaway, bed-wrecked, on an immensely tiny island. And yet the very uncertainty of my predicament brought the thrill of performance. The nervous gut and quickened pulse shaped a very fine attunement of the senses. I felt, in a word, alive. I turned gingerly on my saucer-shaped island, a bit of good-feeling dirt beneath one bare foot, a bit of rough rock below the other. All across my body came the impressions of the soft, blank leaves and the scrawling branches of the island's seven trees, which shot from the meagre outpost like petrified fireworks in all directions. I stepped upon a slinking trunk with the intention that I might survey the far side of the island, as all good castaways must. But what I supposed might be gained upon the instant of a half-step did not bear out. I wrestled along in the piled jungle, opacified in the shields and swords of the leaves and sticks, with my eyes being poked and all manner of injury scoring my exposed skin, to the point where I wondered if ever in the history of time any man had been murdered by the steady touching of such a stabbing forest. I lunged into a thicket, and then set my feet in the vertex of intersecting trunks, before then stepping back down to the rocky soil. And then up again I went over the reclining fog of trees, into the nape of an elm, and then cutting over the slope of its cross with an oak, and then grabbing hold of a gnarled apple branch and swinging above the small gulf, my free foot catching on the vinyl smooth limb of a cherry. A solid wall of bramble stood before my eyes, and I was forced to lower into the arms of a birch, and then slip gently along the stair-like shoulder of a maple, where, perplexedly, I found myself before yet another elm and oak, which, singular specimens, I felt sure I'd already worked my way beyond. Yet here the two old dodgers were again. Had I somehow managed to turn myself around in the tapestry of forest and circled back? Like the Penrose stairs, endlessly mounting within their closed circuit, the forest had trapped me in its tidy endlessness. Confusion of this sort urges one to the earth, and I crouched to the ground, happy to rid myself of the constant, boiling face of leaves. I crawled in a lowly way over the black soil until the canopy broke above me, and I stood. I was at the edge of a small grotto, green and muddy, which was traced in the background by the full return of winter in the form of a pristine ridge of snow. Tucked within this snow, completely blazoned and white, was a small cabin, quite similar to my own in shape and size. The door stood open to a black interior, from which a most uninviting sound slithered forth. A kind of poisonous auditory snake or sonic barber pole. The twisting dirge seemed to continually descend and ascend in both directions simultaneously, while going nowhere. I entered the open grotto, approached the cabin, shivering with both cold and estrangement. Where only a few moments earlier, I'd felt the entirely relieving sensation of having at last come home, now, as I stood before this facsimile of my own cabin, and within the sonic barbed wire of the unforgiving sound, I felt as far from home as possible. Something hidden, bright on thoughts and shining light. I stood at the threshold and glanced about the space and contents of the doppelganger cabin. There was my table, centered with its stub of candle in a granite pedestal. There were my two chairs, one hardly ever used. The wooden butcher block beside the kitchen sink with a sponge, a knife, and the old crockery lamp. My Indian shawl folded over the reading chair. On the near wall, on a hook with my familiar jackets, was a ratty blanket. I took this down and wrapped it around my chilled frame. As I moved deeper into the room, however, I began to note small differences. The ratty blanket, for example, smelled of dog, where before it smelled of mothballs. The granite pedestal clutching the candle here was marbled grey. Mine was onyx, with waves of white. The chairs had intricate faded markings printed on their seats. Mine were rubbed clean of any imagery. It was a solid replica of my cabin, but a replica nonetheless. Because of this, I suddenly had the tiptoe feeling that I was trespassing in a museum display, that I'd slipped past the cordon, entered the diorama, and was in a place meant only for looking, not touching. Items were just so, perfectly in the right place, glasses on the shelves, little bits scattered on tables, things hanging from nails. The right books. But the objects brought close could not bear scrutiny. The lines were right, the very outer edge was trusty. But the materials were not. The colours were off. The book covers blemished in the wrong spots. An excellent tracing from the distance, but a bad final portrait at near. Yet I couldn't help but acknowledge that both qualities, both right and wrong, had been offered plainly for their discernment. On one hand, I was meant to find myself at home. On the other, I was meant to know it was a copy. I was not, in a word, meant to be tricked. Similarity and difference were to be observed in their juxtaposition. In the corner, beyond the kitchen, past the bedroom door, was the one major feature of violation. And to call it that is itself perhaps not right. But folded out from the wall above my writing desk was an old cabinet crammed with recording gear. Wires dangled between small boxes and inserted into a blizzard of silver pluggings. There were blinking lights and a gallery of toggle switches. Amidst all the dials and wires was a reel-to-reel deck quietly spinning, one side of black tape emptying into the other. A noble rusted microphone stood on the desk beneath these mechanisms, with a black headset hung low beside it. I supposed it must be a kind of recording station. I stepped closer to the desk. Beneath the microphone was an old sketchbook filled with numbers and scribbles and small drawings. In the same corner, in my real cabin back on Market Mountain, above my desk, just such a cabinet door was nailed to the wall. I have never tried to pry it open, thinking it simply a makeshift wallboard, chosen from a pile of scrap and thrown into position because it fit. There are many such unusual boards in my cabin, dust-coloured planks embedded with iron that look to have been scavenged from some old ship. The floor in my closet is, in fact, a barn door. Much of my cabin has this elsewhere quality, as though each piece had served an original purpose in a foreign structure. On the floor beside the desk was an old cathedral radio, its centre dial glowing with the yellow wax of candle fire. My own radio at home was broken. The intricate auditory illusion, I supposed, was being piped along from the spinning reel-to-reel deck directly to the wooden radio. As the cold brought a new attack to my body, I abandoned my curiosity for the moment and struck into the bedroom. I spied my similar bed with its similar dark covering and opened the door to my similar closet with its barn door floor. I took a white shirt from a hanger, and without looking, as if to challenge the cabin with my body's memory, I reached for and found my single, all-purpose, black and gold bow tie, good for funerals, good for napping. I took my dark common suit off a shadowy peg in the closet corner. I brought these, my almost things, and laid them on the bed and got myself dressed. There was dry wood in the rack near the stove, and I set a quick blaze, and then drew a chair to the fire to thaw. The constant glissando of noise was irksome, largely because I continued to be tricked by the sense of its movement. But yet, I was fascinated with the inkling possibility that it might change or come to an end. I held myself to the flames for a longest while, until the inner feeling of juggling plates subsided and gentleness came to my old bones. I regarded the objects on the desk. I pushed aside the heavy microphone and searched for meaning in the timeline and schedule in the notebook. The neat pencil script dictated a time sequence and corresponding pattern of numbers, but I found these incomprehensible. And then came the announcement.
Scheduled broadcast of Atoms, Motion, and the Void to commence in 2 minutes.
I regarded the rather prominent clock on the desk. It was 2:50 in the morning. In the schedule book below, I saw corresponding to the 10 o'clock hour a sequence of numbers. 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42. And I noted, at the very top, a quickly scribbled heading. Atoms, Motion, and the Void. An arrow pointed from this and titled up the contents of a very small depiction, a graphite sketch of the surrounding area. A small picture of the island, with the cabin in the center, surrounded by a vast wasteland. As I looked at this thumbprint drawing, I detected very faint, very small letters. In the lake, there stood the word Void. Next to the island, anchored to a connecting line, was the word Atoms. And now, because I knew the third word must be there, I brought the notebook close to my eye. Very small dots led from the cabin to the lake, from the atoms to the void. Footsteps, I thought these small dots must be. And beside them, in the tiniest script I imagined I could read, the word, Motion. As I set the notebook down, I spied one last curiosity. At the top of the page, at the very outskirts of the so-named void of the lake, there was a small, ripped-away scrap. A tiny corner of the page had been torn off. I cast about the desk and floor to find this lost bit. I don't know why I hadn't seen it earlier, as it stood out so strongly white as against the black of the iron. But it had settled or been placed on the base of the microphone. Faint script on the fibre of the paper. The single word, no larger than an ant. I turned the shred to the light and read it aloud. Westbrook, I read, not amazed, not astonished, but disbelieving absolutely. I set the piece down into place, the atoms of the cabin, the motion of the footsteps, the void of the lake, and at the very edge of the latter, Westbrook. But I did not have long to dwell on it. It was 1 minute to the hour, 1 minute to the program. A red light flickered to life in the cabinet above and then slowly began to swirl in a glass sphere. On the sphere itself came the illuminated words, On Air. 10 seconds before the hour, and the light brimmed solid and stopped spinning.
You're listening to Atoms. Motion.
The announcer's voice called. 3 things happened next in loose simultaneity. The radio beside me turned on. The reel-to-reel deck swam to a halt. And lastly in this series, an emerald light began to glow from the base of the rusted microphone. I listened to the wind battle of static, waiting for the program to begin. After 2 minutes of this lightly trampled silence, I stood and began to rove through the cabin, gently ransacking every drawer, turning over every item. What I was looking for exactly, I couldn't say, but after some 30 minutes, the announcer's voice returned for a sign-off.
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion,
and the Void.
The green glowing microphone went dark. The tape deck recommenced its awful swooning. But it was here, finally, as the microphone died, as the programless program came to its whimpering end, that I realized the mirror's reversal. It was not I who was waiting for the program to begin. It was the program that was waiting for me. Two intersecting challenges, two connecting mysteries, swam in the air around me. The first seemed a clear request that I sit at the microphone and fill the 30 or so minutes of the Atoms program. The second mystery was beyond inscrutable. As a younger man, I had served out the remainder of my military service at a cold, wasteland outpost known as Westbrook Station. Because I could not now remember much of that long-ago experience, Westbrook Station had assumed a mythical standing in my mind, an unconfirmable, dream-like quality. To be challenged by the reminder that Westbrook was both real and just on the other side of the lake was too much in two places to be believed. But as to the first mystery, I had a better sense. The notebook's schedule and list of numbers were the first clue. The beckoning, glowing microphone and the 30-minute interval of staticky silence were the second. For it was a numbers station. I had been entranced by such things as a boy and had spent one summer in the hypnotic snare of cryptography. Every night, as my parents read the newspaper in a distant room with half-closed eyes, I would huddle alone before our cabinet radio with a pencil and a pad of paper. I would here and there fine-tune the wild end of the radio spectrum as I listened in complete wonder as the childlike jingle commenced, and then as the lifeless, otherworldly voice read out a random chain of numerals. I wrote each down with the hope that I would one day crack the code. It was the equivalent of seeing ghosts or glimpsing aliens. It was evidence of unfathomable mystery. My parents coldly related what they'd read in the papers, that numbers station broadcasts were an extension of the weather service. There were pilots in the sky who made use of such shorthand. I was appalled by the dullness of this explanation and refused to believe that any mystery could be so sadly cancelled. And yet, they never wavered, and eventually I succumbed, both in mind and spirit. Much later, I was very pleased to learn that numbers stations had a much richer purpose. They were used by almost every government as a way to communicate information to embedded operatives, who could then be summoned into action by a coded message. It was a hide-in-plain-sight kind of smoke signal. The brilliance of numbers stations was their brazenness. Anyone with a radio could listen in without trouble, but decoding these messages was nearly impossible. Only the lurking spy would have the cryptographic key. While I was in some measure thrilled to now be on the other end of this boyhood fascination, I wondered what, if anything, might be triggered by my reading the numbers over the air. Who was out there waiting for my broadcast? Unanswerable, but at least my way was clear. At the next scheduled broadcast, an hour thence, I would sit before the microphone and read the numbers off. Until then, I thought I might take my atoms into motion and pay a visit to the void, to look out across the white expanse, to see if I might get any impossible glimpse of Westbrook. At the door, I grabbed hold of my hat and a heavy jacket from the mean system of sharp hooks and nails. The hat was a little too large, and the coat very stiff, as compared to the well-worn originals. My hands absently reached for and found an odd version of my cane in the bucket beside the door. It was absurd that I was so nonplussed, so eager to rely upon this stock of props as though they were my own. I buttoned the stiff coat on the porch, affixed my gloves, and headed off. A fresh snow was falling, yet the air had a tang of warmth. The trees were assimilated, white fluffy skeletons blooming along a declining shelf of land that had the slump and shapely run of my own property. I descended down into a clearing in a fog of snow and entered the trickster forest. The cloud-tucked sun held a summery print upon the air, but yet the snow continued to gain its advantage, and soon I was stomping through high banks within the strange marbled mixture of summer air and wintered earth. The deeper the snow, the lower the trees, until it felt that I was moving over a buried forest. This blended finely into an open expanse, and I found myself at last at the hard edge of the lake. The wide plain of ice stretched out beneath a hanging blanket of cloud. Along the horizon, the coagulated storm bank was so violently snowy that it had narrowed into a black band. Against this roughness of forms, there came a sweet, flowery scent in the air of the distant clouds' combustion, of the hard-going, floating machinery at work, the sugared fragrance of transition, of change of state, water to frost. I could not see beyond the storm's skein of precipitation, but there was not the least sign of my old polar outpost. I stepped onto the ice and tested forward. As I proceeded, the clouds above me revealed an imbricating pattern of partial overlap, and in the very thin spaces where the clouds failed to touch, and despite the fact that it was morning and the sun was thrumming away in pearly evidence, I could see stars. I ceased to breathe upon such a vision and stared upward at the splinters of space between the clouds, at the purest nighttime stars, embedded in black. I chanced between the elements, the snowstorm and the mounting bands, the glaucous disk of the sun, and then the crease views of the midnight sky. Could any phenomenon of clouds, I wondered, account for such a vision? I imagined a vast kingdom of mist, standing tall to the edge of space, occluding the light of the sun so completely that the blue of the sky was withheld. But my time was getting short. I looked at my wrist as though there might be a watch. I did not want to miss the next scheduled show, my first broadcast, and it seemed to me that filling the empty program with the required numbers would have to begin some series of events, some resolution to the ongoing riddle. So I turned from the lake, from the void, from Westbrook, if it was there, from the broken admixing concept of day and night, from the winter and the summer as they blended around me, and headed back to the cabin, to the numbers station, to await the commencement of the program, and when it was time, to read off the string of numbers.
Steps and snowbanks play yesterday. And how long you build your heart, then pull it apart. How long you build your heart, how long you build your heart, then pull it apart. How long you build your heart. Chains down from heaven, snow builds a man. Burn down the figure, see where you stand. How long you build your heart, then pull it apart. How long you build your heart, how long you build your heart, then pull it apart. How long you build your heart.
Took off my jacket, set it on the hook in the slow water of my attention. I was not concentrating well. This compiling junket of troubles had made a traffic jam of my thoughts. I was standing for moments at a time with my fingers lolling my jacket buttons on and off. Finally, to urge myself to conduct the business of removing the coat, I had to ask my arms to kindly push along toward the hook. I dawdled and whiled, and then pushed myself toward the corner of the room. With a catalogue of instructions, I sat myself into the chair. Bend, settle, hands to the desk, drop the weight, recline, straighten, be ready. The large, quiet clock registered the stone face of an owl. It was 2 minutes to the hour. In 2 minutes, I would let my voice upon the air, deliver the coded message of numbers, and perhaps engage some covert operative into an unimaginable action. I waited, 1 minute before the commencement of the show, and the on-air light began to swirl. The microphone glowed green. I leaned toward the rusty flange, toward its cold mouthpiece, and waited for the announcer's introduction.
Listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void.
My lips touched at the microphone and backed away. I inhaled a deep breath and began to read the numbers off in a dry, strange voice that I suspected was only partly my own. 4, 8, 15, 16, 23.
42, 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42, 4, 8, 15, 16.
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion,
and the Void.
When the program ended, I went quickly outside, nearly stumbling with eagerness. But at once, I could see there had been no change. The snow continued falling, the trees like white paintbrushes. I was on the verge of going back into the cabin when I heard it. A cresting, booming, single explosion, as though the ice of the lake, the void, had torn itself in half. I went as quickly as I could down into the forest, over the tree-tipped expanse of white, and then up to the crusted edge of the lake. The same black clouds roiled and dumped their endless silk. The ice was intact, unshattered, uncracked. But high in the foggy distance, in the drapery of snow, I could discern the vague outline of a low ridge rising gently. And at the highest peak, I could see it. The small golden pinprick of a lamp swinging side to side. I stepped off the ridge of snow upon the rubble of the ice and headed for the station light, for Westbrook, apparently its exponent once more.
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion,
and the Void.